What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins.
Hello there. Welcome to this podcast talking about independent music. We are hanging with the one, the only Chris Evanson. He plays in a band called Sensefield, or I guess maybe say played. Yeah, that's probably appropriate because they no longer are a band. But he also played in Reason to Believe as well. And Chris, I mean, I love Sensefield. Sensefield was one of my bridge bands, and I know that many of you probably have that similar experience where you started to be like, oh, I can listen to music that doesn't just scream all the time. Like, and these guys also come from the same world as I do. And Sensefield was a huge band for me to introduce that whole scene, indie rock, emo, whatever you want to call it. And unfortunately, John Bunch, the vocalist of Sensefield, passed away a few years ago, if not, man, 2015, I want to say. It's been a long time. But I've had Chris kind of always in my mind to be like, oh man, I'd love to pick someone else's brain in Sensefield. And I ran across his wife in my travels. And so we were able to connect the dots, and I had Chris on the show. And it was a great discussion because he talked about all of his life growing up within the sort of South Bay punk scene. And I got to pick his brain deeply about their dealings with major labels. And just that there was a whole Sensefield record that got shelved and buried. A lot of those songs ended up coming out on the Tonight and Forever LP, but a lot of them didn't. And I got to, you know, ask him a bunch of nerdy questions about that. But you can always email the show. Please do. I always like to hear from you, whether it's guest ideas or just to say hello. 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. I promise I read all of them and I respond, you know, sometimes a little bit slower than others, but, you know, we still get it done. And you can also review the show, you know, Apple Podcasts. Just drop some sentences on there, maybe drop a few stars on there. I would appreciate that. It just makes the podcast legitimate, okay? That's what I got for you from a business perspective. And let's talk to Chris, okay? I look forward to bringing you more discussions. And you can stick around at the very end of the conversation. I always tease out who is coming up on the show next week. So that's what we got. But here's Chris, and let's do it. You know, here I am, a Southern California hardcore kid around the age of, you know, 16, 17 years old. And, you know, by that time was very much involved in the, Victory Records straight edge hardcore scene, as it were. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I was a fan of Rev as far as like the stuff that they were putting out. But it wasn't until the In Flight compilation where I heard Building. And it was one of those things where between that song and Texas Is the Reason's Back into the Left, where I was like, oh, I'm allowed to like stuff that is not just screaming.
Yeah.
And it was such a, you know, a gap. You know, a bridge between the two gaps, as it were, between hardcore and then obviously the melodic music. I am sure that sentiment has been shared with you on numerous occasions where, you know, maybe you guys are obviously that particular era was being able to kind of, you know, usher younger kids along to being able to understand that, yes, you can like stuff that doesn't just scream in your face. Am I correct in that assumption or no?
Yeah, we were an odd fit for Revelation. I kind of always were. I mean, we came from, you know, the hardcore, you know, punk world and stuff. But by the time, and we were kind of reticent to kind of jump back into kind of that association again, you know, after Reason to Believe and, you know, like that positive hardcore days, you know, all that kind of stuff. We kind of tried to steer clear of it, but then it just was, you know, it's like the audience found us, you know, it's one of those things. And it just seemed like, well, these are the people that end up kind of liking you. So it's like, you know, why would we not embrace that? We just always figured, you know, the people that like hardcore would just like, would be like, ew, yuck, you know, what is this? You know, it's like soft, wimpy music. And, you know, but that's kind of how it happened. Like with us, with Revelation, I think that as legend goes, it was some of the guys in like the Rev warehouse that were liking our first little self-released CD and turned Jordan onto it. And that's how we ended up on Revelation. Yeah, but it was always an odd fit. And, you know, we were always paired with hardcore bands and stuff like for the longest time. And that was always kind of an odd experience too, because, you know, that's when people started calling us emo, and not in a positive way, but like emo as in they're like wimpy and stuff you know,
right, as a pejorative,
hardcore and like, oh, that's that emo shit, you know. Yeah. You know, and it wasn't until years later that stuff kind of became like hip, and you know, those kids have been into that stuff.
Yeah Well, I mean, and I think it contextually it makes sense obviously why you guys would be pulling from that, because not only was that the vibe of the mid to the late 90s where bands just played with each other because that's what they did and that was the scene they came up in, but yeah. I think it was, I do think that, you know, Sensefield definitely was a band, like I said, to be able to hopefully open kids' heads up a little bit more to the understanding that, like, yes, like this is okay to like melodic music. Like, trust yeah. us, like we're okay.
Yeah, no, definitely, because that's like John Bunch and I both, you know, we both love hardcore music, but the hardcore music we liked was Scream, like early Scream and 7 Seconds and the stuff that had, you know, had a little bit of like a tiny bit of melody thrown in there with like the, you know, super fast rhythms and whatnot. You know, and that's kind of, yeah, that's where we ended up. But yeah, it's cool. I mean, I don't know. It's good. It all looks, you know.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where, because of the historical context in which, you know, the scenes you guys grew up in, like, even though stylistically, you know, you might not have stacked up to a lot of the bands on the, you know, Revelation roster, you still at the core of it were, you know, punk and hardcore kids. And so it's not like you could really argue the fact that, like, oh, Sensefield doesn't belong on this. It's like, no, you do. 'Cause like, that's the scene they played in.
Yeah. It makes sense. I mean, I liked hardcore music and then I liked what we did, so why wouldn't some other people also be able to appreciate kind of both sides, you know?
Sure
I guess you don't give the audience, you know, kind of give them the benefit of doubt, you know. Mm-hmm.
yeah and I think yeah, and plus, like, I you know, like I was saying, I think that particular era was, you know, such a shift in regards to the way that, you know, people viewed what independent record labels were, where it's like you could paint more outside the lines and release stuff that isn't typical of the catalog of the, you know, particular record label. And people yeah. would be like, oh, okay, like Beta Minus Mechanic, I don't know if I can do that, but, like, you know, Sensefield's pretty cool. Or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we were when we started, I mean, we were doing both Reasonably then Sensefield kind of concurrently for a little while, and still playing shows as Reason to Believe. And, you know, once we'd started doing like the Sensefield thing, which was really just the most current Reason to Believe lineup plus one person. And, you know, we kind of were out in the wilderness there for a while. Like, we just kind of were floundering around there doing our own thing, kind of with no, you know, no scene to kind of support it. And, you know, I don't even know where I was going with this, but it was like, my point is we didn't even know what we were doing or what, there was no rationale behind it. There was no, let's do this because this is cool or this is popular. It was just like, you know, we just explored new things and just, you know, kind of hoped there would be somebody there that would want to hear it, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I totally get that. And yeah, especially when you're working with a label that has a track record for, you know, being reputable and not like, you know, predatory and screwing people over. It's like, oh, no, Rep, like, you know, Rev's got a good rep, so this is cool.
Yeah, Jordan was always very supportive and very, you know, he was a fan and, you know, we had a good relationship with him and all the other people at Revelation. They were all cool, you know, very supportive, yeah. Always came to the shows and stuff like that. And that's one of those things that bands usually appreciate is when the label actually, like, comes and sees them play and, you know, like, right, actually gives a shit. So, you know.
Yeah, instead of just, yeah, viewing you as a commodity, it's like, oh, wow, this person actually likes our music. Like,
that, I mean, we were on other labels later, you know, that, you know, like the last label we were on, when we had like Save Yourself on, like those people at that label, they never came to see us. They didn't, you know, such a different experience. Even people at Warner Brothers, when we were on Warner Brothers for a while, they were supportive and always came to see us and stuff like that. But,
yeah. I'll pull some of those threads a little bit later, but I wanted to focus, yeah, on you where, you know, I know you were born and raised in the LA area. Where in particular were you kind of come up?
I grew up in the South Bay area and actually in Palos Verdes.
Okay.
Are you a Southern California native?
Yeah. I mean, I live in Newport Beach, but I've moved around to all, you know, in the Orange County area. So, but yeah, Rancho Palos Verdes and all that.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Which was an odd place to grow up when you got into punk rock, because it was like maybe half a dozen people into that music up there. It was pretty isolated, but it was also kind of fun. I mean, it was kind of a bubble, but very, you know, insular bubble. I mean, like you grew up in Orange County, so there's punk rock all around you down there. But the closest for us was, or like, I mean, a lot of bands. I mean, there were bands from the South Bay, obviously Black Flag and Circle Jerks and Minutemen and all these other, like San Pedro and Redondo Beach bands. But you know, we had to travel to actually go see a show and whatnot.
Yeah. Well, it's like, I think for most people that, you know, you describe whether it's Malibu or Rancho Palos Verdes, like these things are so geographically removed where it's like, yeah, there's only one way in and one way out, or you drive, yeah, over the mountains and it's like, that just doesn't, you know, to your point, that does isolate you from, you know, a lot of what's happening around you, even though you live in Southern California. It's like, well, you know, I got to drive at least half an hour in order to like get anywhere. And when you don't drive, that's not easy.
Yeah, no, it's tough when you're a kid. I mean, because I started going to punk shows when I was 14, and, you know, you had to rely on an older kid or somebody to take you to the show. So, but, I mean, it's also kind of what made it exciting, you know, going to see stuff like that back when it was, like, dangerous and, you know,
yeah,
very completely different from, you know, your reality, which was safe and, you know, very vanilla.
Suburban. Yeah.
Incredibly suburban. Yeah.
Sure. And I know you have older brothers and sisters, right? Like, where do you, are you the baby of the bunch? Where do you stand?
Yeah, I'm the youngest of four. So God, by the time my parents had me, they didn't even like try anymore. So, you know, we'd get away with a lot more than the older kids. Like, you know, I'm always, when I think about the shit we did back then, it's kind of shocking because my parents were just so oblivious to what was going on, you know.
We'd, sure,
do, yeah, stuff while my parents were sleeping in bed. I'd be drinking with my friends in the backyard or fucking in the living room or something. They didn't have a clue, you know.
So. Sure. Yeah, I'm sure your siblings were just like, I can't believe that Chris is just getting away with murder. And like, you know, we got punished all day long as we were starting to do some of this stuff.
Yeah. It benefits being the youngest, you know.
It does. At that point. Right. Yeah. You're last on the scene and people are just like, oh, as long as he's breathing, he's fine.
Yeah. He's fine.
Right. Exactly. And I know I've just, you know, in doing my nerdy research on you, you know, I know that like freshman year is kind of when you start to get interjected within the more, you know, independent minded music scene and stuff like that. But I guess prior to that, what was your, you know, like connection point to like, who did you find yourself being? Were you like a sports kid? Were you into comics? Like, you know, where were you kind of, you know, painting your identity?
Yeah, that's the thing is before that, I didn't really have much of an identity. I was kind of a semi-nerdy kid. I wasn't like a full nerd, but I wasn't cool and I wasn't popular. You know, I was just like a shy kid who was into like skateboarding, and I didn't even really have like a musical taste up until, and this is going to definitely age me, but until like 1980-ish, you know, when I discovered the B-52s and Devo and stuff like that. And then from there, so like kind of like that new wave stuff. And, you know, back then listening to K-Rock, back when K-Rock actually played, you know, kind of out there music, and listening to Rodney Bingenheimer's show and stuff, and hearing the Adolescents, you know, just want to, Anaheim Band, a full working band. And, stuff like that, Bad Religion and all that other kind of LA punk rock back in the day. And that's, you know, that kind of opened my eyes to that. And, in my freshman year. So, I mean, I was still listening to like Adam and the Ants and the B-52s when I started listening to like, you know, Adolescents and X and things like that. And then once I was, you know, in high school, I met some other kids that were into punk rock, and they kind of, you know, were like my mentors and kind of showed me, you know, other bands to listen to and took me to my first show and whatnot from there. And then it was all over. I was just totally hooked on that.
Band merch is my game, and you need to go to rockabilia.com and use the code 100 words because that gets you 10% off your entire order. And Rockabilia, it is the wind beneath my wings, the wind in my kite, whatever analogy you would like to use, but they're the place where you can buy all of your band merch. And it's not just like one genre of music. They span the entire gamut. I just love that about them because you can solve so many problems. It's like, hey man, maybe my dad likes classic rock and, you know, my mom likes pop and my sister likes indie rock. You're able to solve all of those problems and look like an awesome person because you were giving these really nice specific gifts to them. So please go onto the website. You'll have so much fun browsing around. Independently owned business, you know, punk and hardcore kids that are behind this, they're doing the thing and they've been in business for over 30 years. I love this company so much. So again, use the code 100 words. That gets you 10% off your order. It'll ship to you fast, quick, and you'll be so happy about it. So rockabilly.com, go enjoy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day. Whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade, at The Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97, for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at homedepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See homedepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
And what drew, I mean, I'm going to presume, but I'll obviously let you put it in your own words, you know, what kind of drew you into, you know, those particular, you know, shows and music scenes? You know, was it just the danger like you were talking about before? Was it just because it was so different than everything you'd have witnessed before?
Yeah, it was like, I didn't, you know, I have older brothers and sisters and they all had their own music, and I didn't have my own music that I could claim as my own. It wasn't until I started hearing some of those new wave bands that I thought, okay, this is my thing. You know, this isn't Led Zeppelin and Bowie and stuff. It's you know, this is a new thing. And I liked the way it sounded, and it was exciting. And then I heard that song Amoeba by the Adolescents, which is, you know, really melodic punk song, but they used to play it on K-Rock, and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. And I went and I bought their first record, and I thought it was really scary. Like, I was afraid to even listen to the other songs in the record because they seemed so, like, you know, like, oh my God, this is like so outside, you know, my reality, you know, kids and drinking and drugs and, you know, danger and fighting and all this shit. And it seemed really exciting and adult. And then hearing, you know, I had a friend of mine, a guy a year ahead of me when I was a freshman, and he was into punk rock and he was a skater and stuff like that. And he would tell me about the shows he was going to. And it just sounded so exciting and dangerous and cool. I just wanted to go. And then it was all of those things. It was absolutely terrifying and surreal when I first started going to punk shows, you know, and it just, I think that was the fun, you know. I mean, there's something exciting. I mean, rock and stuff like that should be dangerous and should be kind of scary, and that's what makes it thrilling, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't know, I got hooked on that, I guess.
Sure. Well, I think you articulated it well in regards to the, once you feel like it's your own, and, you know, once you start to feel like you're part of this weirdo secret society that, like, mm-hmm. you know, your parents don't understand, but your siblings are kind of like, well, you know, I don't know what Chris is getting into. Like, he's taking this farther than we did, but that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was also satisfying, like having my older brothers and sisters listen to the music I was listening to, and them thinking that it was really weird and not understanding it just kind of made it better, you know?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Right. Like, you guys don't understand this. You're a nerd or whatever.
Yeah.
yeah. I know that, again, just because I, you know, did a little research where you mentioned that, you know, Bad Brains was your first actual experience as far as a, you know, show was concerned.
Yeah.
Did you get there, I guess, by your, you know, your older brothers or sister taking you there? Was it like friends? Like, how did you kind of arrive at that?
That was like a big show that was coming up, and it was the Bad Brains. I think their first time in LA, and this is in like 1982. And they had put out this cassette on Roar Records, which was kind of their iconic release. And, you know, it was all kind of like all the shit that people were talking about. And anyways, so it was a big deal. And so these, they asked if I wanted to go, some of the older kids in high school. And, you know, I said, yeah, and, you know, I had to tell my parents I was going to a dance. I remember that's what I told them, because I thought they wouldn't let me go if I said I was going to a punk show, you know, in a seedy part of Hollywood. I mean, at 14, I'm pretty sure they would have said no fucking way.
Right.
So I went with a carload of other, you know, older kids from high school. And that was, it's funny because it was at this place called the Ukrainian Culture Center.
Oh yeah. 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 I've been to a show. I mean, they do random shows there like very irregularly, but yeah.
Yeah. And it's on like East Melrose, like east of the 101. There's actually a record store that I would sometimes go to over there too now. And later, Sensfield would play at a show like on like the same block almost, this place called the Macondo in our early days. And then it ended up being there. But, you know, anyway, so that was kind of surreal. But that's where it was. And it was much even seedier then. And for a kid from, you know, like an upper middle class suburb, it was, yeah, it was pretty seedy and pretty scary. But so that was my first experience, and it was crazy. And even for, as you know, I went to many shows after that, but that was still like one of the craziest ones, because going there, standing in line, there was a huge line of people outside to see the Bad Brains because it was like a big show. And you know, like across the street from where we were standing in line, there was a car that was just on fire, like ablaze. You know, there were cops, you know, kind of surveying the line, harassing all the punk rock kids waiting to get in. And, you know, it took forever to get in. We finally got in, and I slammed for the first time and promptly got knocked out while slam dancing. And I took a shoulder to the, or I mean, an elbow to the ear, the right side of my head, knocked me out cold. And then from after that, I was in kind of like a daze for like probably the next hour or so after being knocked unconscious. And so it became even weirder. You know, you're like, I don't know if you've ever been, you know, fainted or been knocked unconscious, but you're kind of like, are pretty disoriented after that. And then I'm disoriented and at a punk rock show for the first time, surrounded by kids that are like a foot taller than me and leather jackets and shit like that. And it was just terrifying. And then to boot, the riot police stormed the venue and tried to shut it down, you know, like guys in full, you know, riot gear and shields and the whole, you know, nine yards. Eventually allowed it to go on, but like that was just like an added layer of just craziness to this already bizarre experience. And but it was awesome. I mean, at the same time, it was just so cool. The music was great. And, you know, I was just totally hooked after that.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. It's, when you have all of these experiences at one show, you know, in your early show going life,
pretty much the entire, every weird thing that could happen at a show happened at that very first show. Like,
right. You know. It's all, it's kind of all downhill from there. You're just like,
yeah, wow, it was like, wow, that was kind of it. That was the ultimate right there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You peaked early, Chris.
Yeah, I did. Right out of the gate.
And so as you started to, you know, get more into this subculture and, you know, kind of find your own lane within the music that you were getting into, you know, how, I mean, I know you said your parents were very permissive and like you said, they were allowing you to do a lot of things that they would not have, that they would have punished your siblings severely for. Were they concerned about the sort of music and weird stuff that you were bringing in the house?
Yeah, they definitely were. My parents are like, were super conservative and pretty square, as it turns out. And it's not like they were permissive. It was more that they just weren't paying attention because they both worked and they ran their own business. And so they were just consumed with that. And so they didn't even like know what was going on half the time. You know, like I didn't get away with doing all the weird shit to my hair that I wanted to at the time, which when you're that age, it seems super important. It's like, fuck, why can't I get a mohawk?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Why can't I dye this blonde? Yeah.
Well, I tried all that stuff. It all looked terrible, but I tried it all, but I'd always catch a lot of shit when I did. They were cool about it because they were supportive in a way, but they didn't like it. And I know they were probably embarrassed by it, you know, when they brought me around their friends and stuff, you know. They got the weird kid, you know, like every parent of a punk rocker thinks, you know. Yeah. I mean, it took us, like, we had to go to, like, parent-child counseling and stuff like that. You know, that was back when punk was, like, seen as a real, you know, kind of threatening and scary thing and something that you need to take a kid to a psychiatrist for. Turns out I was a pretty mellow kid all in all. Like, I had friends that were much more trouble and, you know, did the whole running away from home and all that shit. We're way more into drugs. I was, you know, I did my share of drinking and stuff, but I was never really involved too much with drugs or anything.
Sure. Yeah. You didn't go off the rails. Did you like hear about school? Like what was the kind of, obviously it sounds like your parents were running a family business. Was the idea that you were, going to fall into that line of work?
Yeah. My dad always wanted somebody to take his business over from him and nobody was interested. So
what did he do? He
made like lawn and garden equipment. He had a company that made like, you know, like things like weed whackers and things like that.
Okay.
And he started and ran, and my mom worked, you know, with him as well. But he was, you know, it was once I really got into music and started doing it professionally, he was always really, both of them were very supportive and like pretty cool about it. Were kind of into the fact that I was doing that. You know,
that's cool.
They were very into all of us pursuing things and being individuals and whatnot.
That's good. Yeah. Let you find your own way, whatever that meant. Did you care about school? Like, you know, were
no,
you?
I couldn't stand school. I mean, I wasn't a total fuck up, but I hated school and I put in the least amount of effort I could just to get by. And that's pretty much what I did. So, you know, I mean, I just barely graduated. My last year, I think I just ditched certain classes from the very first day and never went back, and then was like short all these credits and, you know, had to go to an adult school at night just in order to graduate. But, I was never big on school, never big on studying. I just like, ugh, I just hated it.
Sure. It's you you might have been smart, but you didn't apply yourself, Chris.
Yeah, I was a slacker.
And I know at that time too, like you also started drums were, from what I understand, your first kind of love before, you know, you switch over to guitar. Was the attraction to drums just the fact that, you know, it maybe seemed, easier to play because there were no technical notes from that perspective? Or do you just kind of like, hey, I like the drums?
Yeah, I don't know. I was kind of drawn to them from the get-go. And I still to this day kind of like drums most of all. Like I don't know. I like bands that have great drummers. And like when I work on my own music, I'll work on the drums probably more than I work on the rest of it. So that's what I did for the longest time. I mean, not that long. In retrospect, I probably did it for like, you know, 5 years. But, you know, had a bunch of kind of go nowhere garage punk bands, you know, like three or four of those before we started doing Reason to Believe. And all of those I played drums in. Reason to Believe was the first thing where I tried to play a guitar, you know. Was that hard?
Like, you know, going from drums to guitar, you know, that's a pretty big shift. Like, was it, hard for you to kind of pick up, or was it just like, well, because we're just playing power chords, like I can figure this out.
Yeah. That's how I learned. I just learned how to play like 3-string power chords, you know, like the real basic ones. And, we used to practice over at my house and the guitar player would leave his guitar and amp behind. And I would just pick it up and play it when he was, you know, in between practices. And, and, you know, slowly but surely got kind of the hang of it. And you know, I never took any lessons. I mean, it was all just trial and error, self-taught kind of stuff. But I started doing that just because I was just always super into music, and I was a big record geek, and, you know, spent all my money on records, and I just, you know, wanted to write songs like the records that I liked. And so that's why I picked up the guitar, is because I wanted to, you know, write some songs for the old band that we had. You know, and then we did some of my songs, you know, when I was playing drums in my first band, and, you know, I don't know. It's funny to hear them now. It's like, oh my God, am I, like, you just hear how blatant the influences were, like how much I just wanted to sound like certain punk bands in the day.
Of course. That's what you do. You just do, you aim for a target. You're like, all right, I'm going to sound like 7 Seconds. And then you listen back and you're like, oh, so that's like a C version of.
Yeah. What I hear now is sort of some of that early stuff, especially, is pretty embarrassing. It's like, oh my God, it's like, how blatant could I be? It's just, this isn't even very good. Like, I don't know. But
yeah,
you know, seemed cool at the time.
Of course. Well, yeah. And plus, you know, you've got as a kid, you're just shoving a bunch of stuff in your head, and you don't really necessarily can articulate why you're trying to like rip these bands off, but you're just like, well, I like them, so why would I not sound like them?
There's something also, like, before you know what you're doing, that's a good time. Like, there's times where I'm like, I wish that I didn't learn anything about music theory or chord structure or anything like that, because it becomes almost like handcuffs. You just, you know, you're liable to, when you don't know anything, you're willing to try anything and put notes together that maybe don't normally go together. And I think you're more creative. It's once I started learning more about music later, it's like, I felt like, oh, I can't do that. I'm supposed to do this. And it's like, it's just, you know, it's a weird thing, but there's something to the ignorance, you know?
Oh, for sure. And especially too, like as you're getting into music when you're younger, you're getting all into all this stuff devoid of context, rather than like, oh, this band's a part of this scene, and like, you know, this guy sucks because I heard my friend doesn't like him or whatever. You just like bands because of the music they're creating. So it's very similar to what you're talking about.
So
I'm going to presume, did you go to like college? Like, what was kind of the life path? Or was it just like, not like, everything else is, you know, on the side, and like, I'm going to pursue this music stuff, whatever that means.
Yeah, I went to college after high school and put, you know, a minimal amount of effort into it. Was studying, you know, for like, I mean, I was a business major because I didn't, you know what else to do. I didn't care about it at all. Was not passionate about it, and just kind of floundered around for a few years doing that. And, still, you know, playing music on the side, playing drums. And then kind of when I was still in college, which should have been like the end of my college career, but that's kind of when Sensefield started happening. And the kind of the end of college for me is when we kind of started playing more. And I don't think it was our first tour, but basically when we started doing that, I just kind of said, screw it. And I just kind of gave up on college and didn't graduate at that time. I went back later after the band and, you know, finally finished it and graduated. But,
right. Got a piece of paper.
But I just didn't, I was not passionate about it. I just couldn't care less, honestly, about like business administration and stuff like that. And,
right.
You know, music was always my first love. And so, you know,
and that's what that's what you focused on.
Yeah. I did that. I got a job driving a truck and moving freight around the city and
touring.
And just to be able to, you know, afford to play music. And that's kind of where that started.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Reason to Believe was the first, you know, for lack of a better term, like serious band, you know, i.e. putting out records and touring and playing shows and stuff like that.
Yeah.
As as that started to, you know, like go out there and, you know, put out records and everything like that, and have people that like weren't your immediate group of friends being into it. Was there anything that was, I guess, surprising for you, or was there things that you were just like, wow, this is weird. I didn't think this is what tour meant, or any of those things that, you know, you were surprised by as you started to experience it.
Yeah, I mean, it was also, I mean, I'd done it for years just playing to friends and maybe, if we were lucky, playing a party or something like that. So it was just having your music heard by other people in general was totally bizarre, and like having people like it. And, you know, and when Reason to Believe finally, it was when we made our association with Nemesis Records and this guy, Big Frank, who ran Nemesis. And he would get us like legitimate shows, not just little like, you know, self-promoted shows, but he got us on like real shows. And that was freaky, you know, playing, you know, we opened for Fugazi a few times. We played with like the Dickies and Scream and all these other bands. And that was just trippy to play like a legit show with like real fucking punk people and be on the other side. Watched it from the other side for so long, and then being on, you know, up on stage, you know, and playing super fast and hearing people yell out, "Faster, come on, play," you know, that used to be the mantra at the punk shows, is people screaming out, "Faster." It's like, shit, how much faster can we play? I mean, you're great.
Right. Yeah. You're like, we're already kind of hauling out. Like, we can't do much more than this.
Yeah, we're trying our best. But yeah, I don't know. The whole thing was just, yeah, it was weird. And, you know, I credit John Bunch for all of it. I mean, he was the guy who always pushed us to break out of, you know, our, you know, little world and actually do something and to kind of take it somewhere like a real band. You know, he just wanted to be like in a real band that actually did stuff. And, you know, he made a lot of those connections and, you know.
Sure, so. Push it out. Well, yeah, that's the singer's job, right?
Yeah, you know, he's the networker. He was the guy that was friends with everybody, and
yep,
yeah. So,
right, and so that, yeah, that's obviously how you were able to get out there. Did you, in reflecting on your touring experience, not only with Reason to Believe, but Sensefield? I don't know. I was about to say Senses Fail. Clearly, two different bands. But how did your relationship with touring go? Because I'm going to, you know, just in whatever, observing you from a distance, like, you know, you're a pretty quiet and reserved dude, and definitely not like the, you know, guy that's you know, sucking up all the oxygen out of the room, being like, I'm a party animal, crazy guy. And so touring can be difficult for people that, you know, don't have that maybe obvious extrovert nature. Was touring, did it come naturally to you, or was it difficult to kind of get into that groove?
I really enjoyed it. And you're right. I mean, I'm definitely an introvert, and I'm, you know, not the social butterfly or the, but I really liked it. I mean, because touring, like our very first tour was, we did one tour with Reason to Believe, and we supported this band Instead for half of the tour and Uniform Choice for the other half of the tour. And both bands had, you know, actual followings, and we were just some piddly little band who had one little 7-inch out, and nobody had ever heard of us. And so it was like an adventure, you know. It was totally, we drove like a truck with a U-Haul trailer, and, you know, you got to explore the country and make no money and sleep on people's floors. And I enjoyed that aspect of it, you know, like the just kind of getting out there and exploring and just kind of, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And so I kind of liked that kind of early touring days. And the playing and stuff could be a grind, but all the stuff that went along with it, I always found really fun. It was fun to be out there with your friends. And but I always, for the most part, always enjoyed it. You know, the camaraderie, you know, the group, you know, people, you know, enjoy being around and whatnot. You know, a couple of beers too, and I open up and I get pretty
sure.
Get pretty talkative.
Right. Sure. The pirate like nature of your tour van as you're traveling around the country.
Yeah. It was a lot more fun. The times that we did like a bus tour, like that was less fun to me, you know, like way too confined and whatnot, being like in a van and stuff. That was fun. I mean, you know, I did a lot of the driving. And I don't know. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I'm going to fast forward a little bit, but, you know, in regards to, you know, Sensefield, when you guys started to, you know, pick up business implications and, you know, all these things where it's like, wow, we're getting paid, you know, a couple hundred bucks for a show. And like, once that aspect of it started to become, you know, the business started to infiltrate the band. Did you feel, I guess, comfortable? I mean, obviously you feel comfortable with it because you guys went along with it, but, you know, did you enjoy that aspect, or was that like, I want to stay as far removed from it as possible?
I kind of dealt with some of that kind of as just as a necessity, because nobody else would, you know? So a lot of times I ended up as kind of the de facto head of the band. And I mean, for lack of a better word, not like I was really the head of the band, but because
the band dad.
Yeah. Because I was had kind of, I was, the, you know, yeah, I wasn't, some of the other guys were just pure artists, pure, just, you know, they just couldn't even deal with stuff like that. And I could kind of do a little bit of both. And so, yeah, they used to call me the captain. That was my name on tour.
That's, and, so, and when I
they
love
were,
that.
And when they were pissed at me, they'd call me the craptain. If I was getting grumpy or something, but,
okay, so I,
you know, I had to end up kind of, yeah, taking some responsibility. And I was fine, but you know, sometimes it's more fun just to be the kind of guy that gets taken care of, doesn't have to deal with anything, but you know, because nobody else would, I did. So, you know,
yeah, no, it, and sometimes it's one of those things where, if a person who isn't, you know, even remotely equipped to handling the business decisions as the kind of conduit between, you know, record label and the band or whatever, you know, that's when things get really uncomfortable, because the person's like, I don't even want to be doing this. Like, why, just because I'm the singer or whatever, not saying John was saying that, but like, you know, it does get, there's a lot of friction involved with that.
Yeah. John and I definitely assumed that role, especially when we started, you know, like when we did actual records, like with Revelation and then like later labels and stuff. And you know, we both enjoyed that. I mean, I don't know, we typically enjoyed our relationships with labels, you know, for the most part. And, you know, it was, I don't know. Yeah. I didn't feel uncomfortable definitely doing that. It was totally cool with me. Some of the other guys didn't want anything to do with it. But John and I both kind of jumped in there and kind of assumed that role.
Yeah, that's cool.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day. Whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade, at the Home Depot, you can give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97, for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at homedepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See homedepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
And, you know, as I'm going to presume that it was probably, you know, I guess after you know, the second LP came out is when, you know, the major label attention and all that stuff started to kind of trickle down to you guys. And how did you start navigating that world of like, oh, wow, now we have to take this band, not like have to, like, oh my gosh, it's being thrust upon us that we need to take this more seriously, but just like, okay, you know, maybe we didn't toy around with the idea of like being on a major label, but like now we have to kind of reckon with that and consider that. Walk me through the thought process as you guys started to, you know, engage with that.
Well, there were a lot of bands. It was at the time in the mid 90s when a lot of bands in our world were getting looked at and were getting signed. You know, a lot of the bands were getting picked up. Like Jimmy World was already, they were on Capitol Records from the get-go, and they were already on Capitol Records, and we were still, you know, not signed to a major. And like that band Sam I Am had, who we played with sometimes, they had a publishing deal and had gotten like a good advance and stuff. And the guy who signed them to a publishing deal was interested in us as well. And that was kind of like our first kind of foray into like the real kind of like the, you know, the big leagues. He signed us to a publishing deal, and we weren't managed, and he ended up kind of there. We started getting some interest, and he acted as kind of like our, you know, sort of manager in a way at that time, and in fielding calls from majors and setting up, you know, meetings and stuff like that. And we had just gone on our first European tour, and this was like 95, and it was like the most low budget punk rock tour ever. I mean, like, it was rough. Like, it was like 2 months straight playing every night. We came back with no money. The promoter took all the guy who put on the tour took all the money. Sure. So when we got back from tour, suddenly there was some interest from majors, and we're like, okay, this is weird. And so this guy who worked for the publishing company, like I said, started kind of handling this for us. And so we had, you know, quite a few labels, you know, at the height of it that were interested, and, you know, lots of traveling back and forth to New York and elsewhere, and, you know, meeting with people and, you know, having expensive meals on their dime and whatnot, and
right,
abusing their
expense
accounts to, like, you know, to major degrees. It's funny because we were being looked at by Arista Records at one time, who's not known as a rock label. I mean, they're like Whitney Houston and like country artists and stuff like that. But the guy who runs Arista is a legend in the music business. Why can't I think of his name?
Clive Davis.
Yeah, Clive Davis. And he was trying to sign us, you know, and this guy is like big time, right? And we're this this piddly, you know, whatever, post hardcore emo, whatever you want to call it now, band. And, you know, he's, you know, trying to urge us to sign with him. And we took, I don't know, a number of meetings with him. And it's kind of funny, because like I was saying, like, you know, John and I were sort of interested in it, but like Rodney, who's our other guitar player, was pretty much like falling asleep in meetings with Clive Davis and twiddling his thumbs and like just could not care less. And, you know, just surreal now that we were like, wow, I mean, somebody like that stature was actually like actively trying to sign Sensefield. You know, and we weren't even like barely interested. And
right, you were like little children being like, whatever, dude.
Yeah, I know. Somebody that's like so such a huge figure in the industry, like, and yeah, and we're like, yeah, nah, no thanks. So we did that for like a few months of just, you know, meetings and trips and whatnot. And that was one of those experiences that, like, there aren't many times in life when you're in the middle of something that's fun and you actually know that it's fun and that you should be paying attention and enjoying it, remembering what it was. But that's one of those few times where I actually knew that what we were going through was never going to happen to me again, probably. And that I should probably keep my eyes open, enjoy it for what it was, and just, you know, have fun with it. So like John and I both, I think, thoroughly enjoyed that process, you know, just I don't know. It was fun for what it was, you know?
Sure. Soaking it up. What was the, what, you know, kind of on that same tip, the, like you said, you were, you know, having meals on the label's dimes, like all of the kind of, you know, quote unquote, typical stories that you would hear in regards to major label courting. What was kind of, maybe not even in the courting side of things, but, you know, usually once you get thrust onto that major label stage, you get to, you know, they throw you in really weird opportunities where it's like, hey, go play this like children's hospital or like, you know, weird events and what have you. Is there anything that sticks out, like, as I kind of articulate that, you know, in your head where I was like, wow, I can't believe we got to do this or this really funny thing?
Yeah, there was a lot of good stuff in the beginning when we first actually signed to Warner Brothers. We signed like at the beginning of 96 and all of 96. That was when Building came out. It was a lot of touring. You know, we did some Warped Tour. We toured with like the Boston's, which was an odd fit. That was a lot of fun. We toured with Texas The Reason. We toured, I think, Jimmy World that year. I don't know, we did a lot of touring. But once that was all over and we had kind of a lull, to keep us busy, they put us out on this thing that they had going on, this series of snowboard competitions, that whoever was putting on these snowboard competitions contacted Warner Brothers and said, can you give us a band that'll play these things? And they were all over like the Northeast. And so, you know, they volunteered us for that because we weren't doing anything at the time. And we did all of one of those out of like, I think a series of like, I don't know, like 7 or 8 that we were supposed to do. And we did one and then quit because we did this one and it was like, I think it was, maybe it was Vermont, it was Stowe or somewhere like that. And, you know, we showed up. I mean, and it was a scene straight out of Spinal Tap. We showed up, it was up on the hill, up on this, you know, up on the mountain at like, you know, the base, whatever you call it, I can't remember anymore, but whatever, you know, like the main lodge for the mountain.
Yep.
And there was a sign outside, sign that said pasta dinner and Sensfield spelled wrong. And we played, you know, we were second billed to pasta dinner and we had to play up there. And it was like after the competition, like, you know, everybody left the mountain after that. It was in some like bar at the lodge and, you know, it was like not well attended. And, you know, and the people there had to pay us a ton of money because that was the deal. And they're just like, Jesus Christ, I can't believe we're paying you this much money, you know, for having played this stupid thing. It was like, oh my God. And we just said, we don't want to do any more of these. And we had to wait a week between each one and just sit around for a week, play another one, sit around like on the East Coast for a week, play another one. You know, it was such a stupid idea. And we're like, okay, we're not doing that again.
That honestly, that's perfect. Like that is exactly what I like to hear when I ask that question, because it is, yeah, you just get thrown these random ideas and you're just like, sure, we'll play a, you know, a ski lodge.
Yeah,
second we want to be pasta.
Yeah, we're team players. We'll do this. Sure. It sounds great. You know? And it's like, totally. Oh God, it's just a total like confidence, like destroyer. You know, it's one of those things you just, fuck, right. What am I doing? Is this where we're at? Like, oh my God.
Yeah. I'd rather play a show to 2 people because we know those 2 people will be there to see us at least.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was totally demoralizing.
And I guess on that demoralizing tip, and not to, you know, trudge up, you know, past wounds or anything like that, but I remember, like, I was working at a record store here in Orange County called Bionic Records. And I remember getting, I still do have the promo of your Warner Brothers record that obviously got shelved and, you know, you guys ended up reworking it, obviously. But I can only imagine that process was I can't even believe that you guys were able to sort of gather up your fortitude to be able to like go on, because, you know, usually that's like the pinnacle of a horror story for bands to get their record shelved or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I guess without being, I guess, overly dramatic on my part, like, was it as, I guess, demoralizing as what I would maybe anticipate it to be?
Yeah, I mean, hearing that was about to happen, because, first of all, yeah, it was like being, you know, it was like being fired or something. So
right.
We got the news that we'd been dropped and our A&R person had been fired in the same setting. Oh. And, you know, I mean, the lesson was, first of all, don't waste time, you know, to any band out there, just get your record out, move, don't sit around, because, you know, like, time is the enemy, you know. And we were taking our sweet time in between when we put Building out and when we were, you know, we spent like a year just demoing songs. We spent forever recording the record, and that wasn't all our fault. It was the person that we were working with as a producer was just not, was like, yeah, I'll fit you in between all my other, you know, better paying jobs. And so we were like, it just, the whole process took a couple of years, you know, and that's ridiculous. We should have just, you know, jammed it out quickly, kept moving, but we just sat there and just screwed around for way too long. And in that time, you know, the leadership at the label had changed at least once or twice, and we dodged lots of bullets, and, you know, and finally, you know, we just couldn't dodge another bullet. A new guy came in, cleaned house, got rid of a lot of the stuff that they had that, you know, he didn't care about. And we were, you know, one of the casualties of that. So, yeah, that was a shocker. And, you know, it took a little while to regroup. But in those weird moments, you know, your kind of instinct says to just, you know, not let it affect you, is to pick up and try to keep going, like, as if everything is normal. So we went right out on tour pretty soon after that happened. We went out with Jimmy Eat World, this time as support. You know, the first time we went out with them, they were supporting us. That was another one of those weird moments. We were like, huh, boy, you know, how things have changed. So, you know, they were taking off, and we went out and supported them, and we had a good time, and that was cool, and, you know, they were nice guys. And you know, when we got back, we decided, let's just, you know, because we had kind of been able to set up our own studio in El Segundo with the Warner money. You know, we had like a little place that was all our own, that we had like a kind of little studio set up in, a control room and the whole nine yards and equipment and whatnot. So we were able to do our own recording. And I had just bought a Pro Tools rig of my own. And so, you know, we just said, well, screw it. We'll just re-record these songs and try to do something with it. Because what the hell else are we going to do, you know?
Right.
You know, no, I mean, seriously, it was just like, I don't even know what else would we do other than that, you know?
Sure, sure. It's kind of, that's interesting. I never, I guess, thought about it from that side of the coin, where it's just like, well, we don't know what to do, so we'll just do what we obviously have known to do. And that's just like, well, we'll just get room and, you know, work on some songs.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we weren't ready to give up. I mean, it was like we had the rug pulled out from under us, you know, just as for the moment when we thought, you know, things were all going to come together, and then, you know, to get tossed out on our ass. And then, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So we, for that one, we redid a lot of the songs, but like John didn't have the energy to just revisit doing the same old shit. So he insisted that he just rewrite the lyrics, rewrite the melodies for certain songs, and just kind of reinvent them in his own mind. We added some new ones, and you know, just fucking just flew by the seat of our pants and just tried to do something.
Sure.
Like, yeah, that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm guessing too, like, you know, once you guys obviously were able to move past that and, you know, released Tonight and Forever, and, you know, that was, you know, arguably probably your, I guess, you know, largest selling record, I'm guessing.
It was, you know, by, you know, mostly on the strength of Save Yourself, which became a single. You know, we never even had a single before.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, the guy that did the radio with the label we were on, you know, felt strongly about that one. We're like, oh shit, okay. I mean, go for it. And, you know, he actually, you know, got on a lot of stations in the country, and it was actually doing really well. In certain markets, it was like a top song. You know, it was climbing on K-Rock too here. And then the label just wasn't able to kind of get the product into the stores to kind of capitalize on whatever momentum there was, and it fizzled out eventually, but should have done, you know, it should have or could have done better than it did, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I remember in just kind of, you always feel like this, obviously, when, you know, bands from, you know, your scene or whatever have levels of success, like, you get excited when like the mainstream public is like, oh, wow, you get to hear Sensfield now. Like, that's exciting. And I just remember it's like you guys popping up on music sound or like movie soundtracks. And it was like, what? Like, this is wild. Yeah, but it's cool. It's cool because, like you said, you're just trying to capitalize on the momentum that is sort of, you know, happening for you guys at the moment. So it's like, you know, it's all exciting at that point.
Yeah, and it's kind of out of your, you know, it's out of your control too. I mean, the label is going to do what they're going to do to sell records, but we're into it. You know, yeah. We had song. I mean, that whole thing. I mean, none of it seemed real, you know, as it's happening. But it was fun at the same time, and it is neat to hear your song and like something like a TV show or a movie.
Totally. You know. You're like, this is the last place that I would ever hear my song.
Even hearing it on the radio was the weirdest. Like hearing it on K-Rock and stuff like that. You know, because I listened to K-Rock from when I was like, you know, 12 or 13, and so that was definitely surreal. Like hearing a DJ like introduce your song and whatnot.
Sure. Here it is on Kevin and Bean in the morning or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. two last things before I let you go. One of them was the, as the band started to, you know, wind down in regards to, you know, touring as actively as you guys were doing and, you know, kind of figuring out what those, you know, next steps were, was that difficult for you to kind of like quote unquote transition into real life? I know that obviously you as a person, like, you know, you're not like, hey, look at me, I'm Chris from Sensfield, I'm the, you know, ego guy or whatever. But, you know, was it, was it hard to kind of, you know, go out of being that, you know, unit that you guys were?
Yeah, it was definitely. I mean, after we decided to stop doing the band, you know, I went back to school and finished my degree and all that. But it is... there's definitely your identity is being a guy in a band, you know, and there's whatever notoriety that goes along with that. You know, you get used to that, you know, not like you're special, but like being noticed for being a part of something, you know, that makes, you know, that's part of your identity. When that goes away, I mean, there's an adjustment to that, you know, and you try to hold on to that, not in like a cocky kind of arrogant way, but just, you know, and it sounds cheesy, but there's a feeling of some level of specialness that goes along with being in a band, something that, like, you know, strangers are into, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when that goes away, yeah, it's definitely weird, you know. You lose that, and it takes a little bit of, you know, adjustment to becoming, you know, just whatever, just average Joe, just, you know.
Well, to be clear, Chris, I did not call you an average Joe. No, just kidding.
Well, that's once I started going to school and I got a job, you know, my first, honestly, like I'd gone my whole life without having like a real job, which is scary. Like I didn't have a real job until I was in my 30s and, you know, like a full 9-to-5 kind of thing. And then doing that and then you're just sure. You're just like a peon and it's like, oh God, this is just weird, you know? But everywhere I worked or have worked, the people have always liked that part of my backstory, you know. You know, I don't want to say you get like special treatment because you don't, but people always, you know, enjoy that.
Sure. Well, they're like, whoa, Chris, you played in a band? Like, whoa, that's weird.
Yeah. Especially knowing me because I'm reserved and I'm, you know, an introvert, and people like you were in a band. How is that even possible? It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, totally.
A couple beers and all, and I'll show you.
Yeah, it sounds like that's the motto in your life, Chris. Show me a few beers, and I'll show you.
Sometimes that's what it took to come out of my shell. Yeah,
understood completely.
Yeah.
And wrapping things up, clearly you still obviously care about music, and you are, you know, the punk and hardcore and everything that you have kind of, you know, grown up with is still an important part of your life. What what keeps you connected or caring about that? Because, you know, I mean, ostensibly, once you reach a certain age, like, you're supposed to, quote unquote, age out of it, or just be like, oh, yeah, like, you know, yeah, I don't listen to the Buzzcocks anymore because, you know, I'm listening to movie scores or whatever. You know, maybe I'm speaking more about myself, but what keeps you connected personally?
Well, yeah, I'm embarrassed to say I don't listen to a lot of newer artists. I mean, there's maybe a handful that I've heard that I liked. People like Ty Segall or,
oh, sure,
you know, like the Cloud Nothings or some bands that I've heard recently that I think are cool. I listen to a lot of old punk rock. I mean, when I stopped doing music, it was kind of a weird thing because when I played music and wrote music, I felt other music felt almost like competition to me, so I didn't enjoy it as much. So not doing it has allowed me to enjoy listening to other bands more. And, you know, I just kind of got back into, like, I was kind of a record geek before, and I'm back to being a bit of a record geek now. I spend way too much money on old punk rock and stuff like that. And, you know,
where are you doing? I mean, obviously you're doing a lot of online shopping because yeah, that's clearly the only option.
A lot of Discogs and nice. eBay and, other outlets, specialty stuff, but, you know, expensive punk collectibles and new wave stuff. And, you know, that's kind of how I've kept interested. So I haven't lost that. I mean, music is still the thing that I'm most interested in. You know, there's nothing better than hearing a great song for the first time and, you know, falling in love with a record and stuff like that. That's still, you know, kind of, there's nothing that really beats that.
Yeah,
it becomes harder and harder the older you get. You become jaded, but occasionally something comes along and you feel that feeling again, you know, where you just get super excited to just listen to something over and over again.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think that's, to me, that's the most important part, where it's like, it's not necessarily that you're keeping up on, like, oh, wow, look at this, you know, new 7-inch from this young band down the street or whatever. Like, you know, that's cool. But as long as you still have that feeling, you know, when you do hear something new, that's like, oh, yeah, like, I'm here for it.
Yeah. For me, I just went backwards. I went backwards from where I came aware of music, and I'm listening to stuff that's slightly a little bit older that I missed. And it's all new to me, but it's, you know, it's not new. But it still sounds current because people are still emulating it to this day.
Sure. Right. Yeah. As long as it's new to you, that's all that matters. Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you so much for hanging out, dude. I really honestly appreciate you letting me ping pong around your life like this.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It was fun.
There we go. That was Chris. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule, because I know, you know, I sit there on a podcast and get punished about your old bands. Sometimes that might not sound so fun, but Chris was a great sport, and I had a lot of fun conversing with him. And also, big shout out to his wife, Monica, who is a great human being. And she's a saint, and she helped this interview happen after she not accidentally, you know, I kind of brought it out of her at one point, and then she was like, oh yeah, my husband played in Sinsfield. And I was like, okay, he's absolutely going to be a guest on this podcast. So next week we have Mike, and I've never said his last name out loud, but Mike Hranica, I think that's how you go. But he plays in a band called The Devil Wears Prada, which, you know, it means a lot of things to a lot of different people. I personally have not been like the hugest fan of The Devil Wears Prada. I appreciate what they have done and how they've expanded their musical spectrum. But Mike has always been a really interesting artist. And when I got the opportunity to have him on the show, I did. I took it. And that's what we got for next week. So Mike from The Devil Wears Prada is on next week. Don't you love the broad base of music that we cover here? I do. And that's, you know, that's what makes me happy. So until next week, please be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yemi's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that.
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to The Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat. Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.